Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Barbara Gale Montero, who is a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. Her work focuses on one or the other of two different notions of body: body as the physical or material basis of everything, and body as the moving, breathing, flesh and blood instrument that we use when we run, walk or dance. Before entering academia, she was a professional ballet dancer, and she's here to talk to us today about her recently published book, Thought in Action, Expertise and the Conscious Mind. Hello, Barbara. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry.
Okay, so could you begin, Barbara, by telling us a bit about your background and what prompted you to write the book?
Yeah, well, I think the reasons why I wrote the book, there's a number of prompts, I guess, and part of it does have to do with my background. And before I started in my career in academia, and actually before college and right after high school, I spent a number of years in the professional ballet world. So I was a professional ballet dancer.
Yeah.
So I came into academia having this background in dance and bodily skill, and having worked for quite a number of years and very seriously on that for a long time. So I had this background, and I had an interest in philosophy of mind. I developed an interest in philosophy of mind in my work as both an undergraduate and graduate student, and this project seemed like a good way to combine them. The most direct inspiration came from a question that I was asked at a talk I gave. It was a job talk for the current position I have now at CUNY. And I was giving a talk on whether ballet dancers, well, dancers in general, have a sense of the aesthetic qualities of their movements.
Yeah.
So whether through proprioception, so our non-visual sense of the movements and positions of our body, whether through proprioception, dancers can sense aesthetic qualities. So aesthetics traditionally is thought of to lie only in the realm of vision and hearing. So this was a sort of different view against the traditional view. And one question I got at that talk, which was from a philosopher who was also a pretty serious golfer. So he said, but isn't it true? Yeah, I was saying, you know, dancers can focus on their movements, and then that would allow them to experience the aesthetic qualities. He said, isn't it true that if you start focusing on what you're doing, you mess up?
Yeah.
And I thought, that is something you hear quite a bit. And so I, you know, at the time I was pretty nervous during my job talks. I didn't really think of an answer. I sort of, I don't know what I said. I tried to cover up my not having an answer about the job anyway. But that question inspired me to start thinking about this. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that when you're really good at something, you can think about it and do it at the same time. So when you're really good in, when you have a lot of training in it and you've had professional level training.
Okay. So first of all, what is an expert as you understand it? You seem to be talking about a particular kind of expert. Yeah.
Good. That's the natural next question, because, we are really good at certain things. Like, we're all really good at climbing stairs and tying our shoes and brushing our teeth. But that, if you start thinking about that, you might mess up, I think, actually. So that's not the sense of being really good or expertise that I have in mind. There are some philosophers who write about skill. The term, of course, expert can be used in many ways. And these philosophers, like Herbert Dreyfuss, he uses the concept of expertise much more broadly, to include everyday skills like tying your shoes or commuting to work. But I use it more exclusively to refer to professional level skills. So not the everyday commuter, but the race car driver.
Yeah.
So race car driver for me is the expertise. You could become, I suppose, an expert at tying your shoes. And I actually did look into this. There are some competitions that, you know, for doing really the best knots. And so you could study that, but I don't think many people do that. So it's something that you've studied and tried to improve over the course of time and have tried to, you haven't just done it like we tie our shoes. We've just done it to try to get it automatic. You haven't thought about it that way. So professional level.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So could you give us an overview of the book then? Just maybe unpack a little more of these concepts of the just do it principle and your position against that.
Yeah. Okay. So in the book, I argue against a view and mostly, and then also try to suggest a positive view. But the view I'm arguing against is what I call the just do it principle. And I don't necessarily mean just do it. And I think the way the Nike campaign means it, but I mean it in the sense of, oh, you know, if you really want to do well, just don't think about what you're doing. Just go out and do it without thinking. This is what sometimes you might hear. Oh, player was doing so well. She was just absolutely unconscious. So it's against that idea.
Yeah.
And I use a number of different approaches to try to argue against this. And one chapter in the book, maybe the longest chapter, is where I address some of the psychological research that is thought to support it. So there's quite a substantial research in psychology on sports mainly that is thought to show that, yeah, actually thinking does interfere with skills that have become automated.
Mm-hmm.
So one project is really just trying to specify what the difference between that view and my view is, because I do accept also that if a skill has become completely automatic, then yes, thinking will interfere with it because, well, what is an automatic skill? Sort of by definition, it's a skill that you do without thinking. Where we disagree is the researchers who argue for what I call the just do it principle. And my position where the disagreement is that they think that many more skills are automatized than I do. So I think that the professional tennis player goes out there and a lot of what is done is actually consciously controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And on the just do it side, they tend to see more as automated. And so there's more room for the conscious mind to interfere. On my view, I think that the experts often can do things automatically. They've practiced so much that it's possible for them to. And there might be certain situations, like if they're under enormous pressure and they feel that that's the only way they could get by, maybe they would want to, but most often they'll choose to employ the conscious mind as well. So they can perform automatically, but they don't need to. And for the best, I think they will often choose to use the conscious mind because consciousness can help them.
Sure. And how does this relate to, say, the work of Daniel Kahneman and the two systems?
Yeah. So he has a distinction between system one and system two. And so one is a fast thought and one is a slower thought.
Yeah.
So I have one chapter in my book called Thinking Fast. Okay, so Kahneman is, a lot of his research has been focused on finding flaws in intuitive thinking, in our intuitive reasoning process. So that's really in line with my work. So he hasn't done as much research, or I don't know, on bodily skills. if we disagree at all, he might say that there's some actions, like on the tennis court, would be system one. And I say there's actually, surprisingly, when you're really good, when you've worked on something so much, system two can come into place too, a slow conscious thought. It's part of the phenomenon that experts often talk about, of time can slow down.
Yeah.
And the tennis ball can start to look like it's coming at you. It's very large and coming slowly, and there is time for some conscious decision making, which, and if you're not very good, you wouldn't have that time.
Sure. I do remember one embodied experiment he did from his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, where he was asking people, they were walking along the street, and he just asked them, what's 4 plus 7 or 3 plus 9? And that just activated the system one thinking. However, when he asked them, what's 13 times 26? Then they slowed down because they went into this sort of system one thing. Now, as a tennis player, is that why sometimes people think that's why slow thinking doesn't work, because it slows you down in an embodied way?
Nice. Okay, that's right. Okay, so there's a lot in that. So, of course, if the people walking down the street, you're asking them to think about something, one, other than what the walking, and two, other than something other than that they've practiced thinking about.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Might be why people, would have to slow down, would have to interfere, because in our everyday actions, like walking down the street, also even if you were to start thinking about how am I supposed to move my legs, or if you bend down to tie the shoe and ahead of time you try to figure out which hand do I start with, which lace go, you might not be able to do it. But if you've practiced thoughtfully, as I think most people who are really good have, then this isn't a foreign thought to them.
Yeah.
The experiment asking people to add numbers while walking down the street, it reminds me of an experiment I ran on chess players, actually, and had them perform addition tasks while playing chess. And what I was interested in was to see, would this interfere? And if it did, in what way might it interfere? Dreyfus had run an informal experiment and found that, chess players, a very good international master, can seem to play just about as well while performing simple addition tasks orally. So I thought I'd try this. And what I found is that with a single digit addition, this was a 1 minute per player game, so really fast, the players were able to perform just about as well. But sometimes when the game got tricky, they would pause. Well, I remember one player I tested, he paused for quite a long time before he was able to answer 9 plus 1. And also afterwards, the players commented that they didn't have to really put any mental effort in the addition, because it's the addition that's automatic, not the chess. So they were able to think fully about the chess and let it automatically pretty much just answer these addition problems. But then also, when I asked double digit, most of the chess players did not want to try this because these were serious chess players, and they were playing online games, and if they didn't do well, it would affect their rating. But I did get one to try the double digit. And international master seriously attacked the addition, but he did play the chess quite poorly and was really upset about that, actually. It did, thinking about something else, did take what seems to be necessary attention and thought away from the chess.
In many ways, what you challenge is this idea of flow, and I think you call it the F word. But it's not that you have an issue with how flow was originally conceived, though. Am I right?
Well, the word is used in many different ways, and a number of people, I think, sort of in the popular press, but also philosophers, you find David Velman, actually, I've seen this, tend to look at, will I pronounce his name right? She sent me Holly's research on flow, and say it supports the view that experts work at their optimal, they perform optimally when they are in this so-called flow, which is, maybe this might not be Csikszentmihalyi's way of thinking out, but which doesn't involve a lot of deliberation.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think there's a couple of problems with that way of thinking about Csikszentmihalyi's research. And one is that his research was focused on optimal experience. So when do you feel best? And rather than when do you perform best? And, you know, fortunately, those two don't always line up. Sometimes performing really well isn't that enjoy. It's great when when you've won the game, you've done really well, but it's difficult. So you have to try harder than you ever have to win an important tournament. So it's not always that pleasant. And he makes it clear that the research into flow wasn't, the original research wasn't looking at optimal performance, but also the concept of flow that, as he explains it, it's not clear that it means the conscious mind does, it's often explained as being engaged. There's a focus. So I don't have anything to say against that idea of flow, but the concept as it's sometimes used in the popular press, whereas the expert performs best when they just let it happen without actually controlling what's happening. That's the idea. I think it's a mistake.
But let's have a look at a couple of other things that you spoke about in the book. For example, choking. What's going on there, especially in the sports situations?
Right. Yes. So some people, and I have experienced it myself, choke under pressure. Well, what does that mean? It means performing much worse than would be expected under the circumstances. So much worse. So a statistical anomaly. You just perform so poorly. And why does this occur? Well, according to one theory that's explained by Sion Bielock in her book called, I think it's just called, well, what happens when the pressure is on? You start focusing on the details of what you're doing, and this messes you up.
Yeah.
So that is very contrary to my way of thinking about expertise, because I say it's one, experts can focus on the details. It's good to think. So her view, she advises the expert to just do it, actually, it's just in her book. And, so what do I say is going on instead? Well, I mean, of course, if I knew, the correct answer, I could probably make a lot of money coaching athletes. But I think there's I don't think there's any reason to think that poor performance, a choke is caused by, well, overthinking by net definition is overthinking, but by focusing on what you're doing. There's interesting research that shows that athletes, soccer players, but I can't remember now the sport, but they were asked to keep journals and how they were coping with high pressure situations. And many athletes said one of the coping techniques was to redouble their focus and actually start focusing more. The philosopher Dreyfus, who I mentioned earlier, he also thinks that choking can occur because of too much thinking. And to add support to this, he talks about the case of the baseball player Chuck Knoblauch. And he had a terrible choke. He was choking, and also there's happened to a number of baseball players. But reading some of these baseball players' accounts of the situation Steve Blass has a memoir. They don't in any place ever mention that it seems that they were choking because they started thinking about what they were doing. I don't think there's any reason to hold that this is why chokes occur. Now, there's another theory of choking, which I think is more likely correct. Well, and at least it fits with my theory. And that is that choke occurs when it's sort of almost the opposite, when you become distracted. So the pressure is on, you're worried about what your family who's out there might think, you're worried about this is the most important game of the season, and you can't focus your mind actually on what you're supposed to focus on. And so that's called the distraction theory of choking. And so that's the view that is consistent with my work on it.
Okay, no, fascinating. So why do you think, why do we value effortlessness, or why do you think this idea of flow has taken such a hold?
Yeah, that's a nice question. Why do we value effortlessness? So part of the reason why the idea of flow might be popular is there is something incredible, awesome, that we find magnificent about people who seem to do things effortlessly. You look at a ballet dancer and it all looks, or it's often supposed to look, not necessarily always, but often it's supposed to look just entirely effortless. And that often looks beautiful. The effortlessness looks beautiful. But it's not always easy to make things look effortless. Why we value it, I don't know, but I have a theory. I think it indicates a superfluity of fitness. Okay, if someone can do that really hard stuff so easily, that person must be really fit. So we sort of see that and value that. But I think that under the apparent flow and effortlessness of the expert, there is often a lot of grit and hard work.
So you're saying it's adaptive in the sense, a bit like, in some ways, like the bird of paradise's tail. It's so good it can nonchalantly have such a large tail.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it might be like that.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And also there's a history of it as well. You talk in the book about how effortlessness and flow are to an extent part of Zen culture or Taoism.
This is at least part of the westernized interpretation of Zen. Zen and the Art of Archery, a book that was quite popular in its day, but was not written by someone who was Japanese. It was a German who wrote it, did go to Japan to study archery. And well, in the book, the idea is expressed that the archer shoots best when it shoots, not the archer doesn't shoot, but the archer has to let it shoot. So it seems like a very just do it, effortless way of thinking about archery, that you just let the arrow fly. So this is a view expressed in the book, and it really grabbed the popular imagination. But more recently, some Japanese scholars have been looking into this, the research that was done on this book, and have found that in the first draft of the book, the phrase "it shoots" didn't even appear. And supposedly, on the day that these words of wisdom, "it shoots," was conveyed to the author, Herigel, the German who wrote Zen and the Art of Archery, that the translator wasn't present. So, it's not clear that this is. Now, this isn't to say that in the ancient, I'm not an expert in Zen tradition, but likely one can find some strands of this idea. But I think that the interpretation certainly isn't this straightforward. a path towards having expertise be an effortless, mindless thing one does.
Okay, and towards the end of the book, you talk about the relationship between expertise, its pursuit, and meaningfulness, giving our life meaning.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, yeah, the big question, of course, but what makes for a meaningful life? Well, Immanuel Kant had one view that we are ethically required to live up to our potential. And so if putting your all into your work is part of what it takes to live up to your potential, this can be part of living a meaningful life. Sean Kelly and Herbert Dreyfuss, in their book, they say that we attain meaning by having an experience of this, in a way, it shoots, of letting things come to you.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if for me that is, at least looking into my own life, if that's something that gives me meaning. I mean, maybe some people have associated the idea of inspiration. All of a sudden you get an idea with, it must have been given, God-given.
Yeah.
And that's maybe, the Kelly and Dreyfuss book is secular, but this might be part of the sort of a background idea. But I don't think that, I downplay this whole idea that inspiration, if it is God-given, well, actually, God could probably do a lot better job of giving some of these so-called great inspiration ideas, because the spark is often, in my view, not what makes for the great work. So it's what's done with it.
Yeah.
And also this supposed spark of the idea is often, well, it's often one that's already been worked out for many years prior, or sometimes it's an idea that actually came from somewhere else, like the Coleridge's poem Kubla Khan supposedly got this great inspiration in Xanadu did Kubla Khan. And this is, it has to be explained as a spark, because you wouldn't want to explain that it came very close to something he was reading right before he supposedly had the dream that this poem was created out of. So I downplay that's so important, this spark of inspiration. And that's where you might think, like, it's meaningful for you. Well, I think it's really in the work and the effort and knowing you've tried your hardest.
Yeah, yeah.
And say a meaningful life.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. And in the book, when you were talking about what makes a good expert, at one point you quote Socrates. Well, you talk about Socrates and his embrace of uncertainty. So is thinking provisionally, by which I mean being open to alternatives and acknowledging that you can be wrong, and curiosity and interest in improvement, that's key then?
Yes. So rather than attaining perfection and then being able to just let things flow, I see the expert more like Socrates, who is really, the better they get, the more they realize that they don't know things. And so the harder it becomes in many ways, because you see there is so much more to do. So I think that is a major sort of a reason why the view of expertise that I have, where thinking is very important, and another view of expertise that sees expert actions as basically automatic, is because I don't actually see it as getting that easy.
Yeah.
Degas, the painter, said that painting is easy when you don't know how to do it, but when you know how, it's almost impossible. So it becomes, when you know how to do something well and you get better, what you're able to find are the more challenges for yourself.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just coming to the end now, Barbara. The middle way, as we understand it in middle way societies, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, and that then throws us back on experience. So we're sort of left in this messy, uncertain middle. But from our position, it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that possibly relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, it sounds like to me that the expert is often living in that messy, uncertain middle because it's not that the expert instantly can see the right way and doesn't need to work to make the decision. You take your, pencil or you go to your computer, and it's not clear at all how for the expert writer to know where to start, to know how to start writing a paper, a book. It becomes, I think, yeah, a very messy situation because you see more possibilities. There are so many possibilities. And I think that's true actually for probably most areas of expertise. So the athlete can see more possibilities on the court than we can. And the chess player can see many more. The grandmaster knows many more possibilities. And so it's a complicated situation they find themselves in.
Okay, great. Okay, well, I'd just like to say to anyone listening out there that I highly recommend the book itself. I found it fascinating, very insightful, and it was a really enjoyable read. It was very funny at times as well. So
Oh, thank you.
it was a great pleasure to read, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you today as well, Barbara. Thank you very much, for giving you up your time to speak to me.
Well, thank you, Barry, for those great questions.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.